This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we're speaking with Ian Burroughs about his book Shakespeare for Snowflakes, published by Zero Books. This book explores the intersection of slapstick and tragedy through close readings of Sarah Kane's Blasted, Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, and YouTube videos of people tripping and falling in public. Ian, thanks for coming on the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
First, I gotta ask you about the title, Shakespeare for Snowflakes. I saw this title. I just happened to be sort of browsing the Zero Books website, and I saw this title and I thought, man, I hope this is actually about Shakespeare in some way so that I can talk about him on the podcast because I just love that title so much, Shakespeare for Snowflakes. So where does that come from?
So this came about, it was in 2017. I was giving some lectures on Shakespeare and some other things, other plays. And because of the other things that I was lecturing on, the lectures arrived with a little content warning for our students. Basically the press got hold of this information, and what started as quite a small story, I think in the Daily Telegraph first, began to run. So it kind of had a bit of everything, I think, for the media. It had Shakespeare in there, but it also had Snowflake students needing trigger warnings. And so that it began to spread quite fast, certainly in the UK. I think it began to be picked up by outlets like Breitbart and Fox in the US. And so one of the phrases, I think, that began to recur in headlines about this story was Shakespeare for Snowflakes with a question mark. So I thought when I was writing this book, I'd kind of want to take that title back in some ways and explain where I was coming from with it. And it helps that it's quite a punchy title, you know?
Yeah. It's, you know, steal from your enemies when you can. I think one of the things that's so funny to me about this trope of snowflakes is that this has become a very common refrain on the right, this idea of, oh, you think you're so special. And yet it's being sort of pervaded by the same people who have insisted on this like sort of individualist frame for thinking about absolutely everything. You know, I mean, I can't think of anything, you know, more insistent on the special individuality of everybody than, you know, a Thatcherite slogan like there is no such thing as society, right? I mean, it's not like they're, you know, it's suddenly the conservatives are the ideologues of the faceless blob or something.
I think that's been one of the interesting things, and it's when you, as I did, begin to explore in different comment threads online, certainly underneath these stories about a content warning being attached to a lecture about Shakespeare, that was a real kind of mud fight between different people of different political persuasions, where people were beginning to accuse each other of hysterical offence, right? So there were right-wingers and left-wingers alike, both citing examples of when right-wingers or left-wingers are offended about things or feel that they have been imposed upon as an individual.
Right, because it's not like one group of people has the monopoly on being offended by stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, I think that was really apparent. And I think there's, I mean, what, where the book, I think, really tried to explore some of the strategies, I suppose, for diminishing your opponent, I suppose, that their capacity for sympathy, proper sympathy, or their capacity to deserve sympathy. That was really interesting. So I think one of the interesting things about attacking someone as a snowflake often is to at once register their offense, but also kind of try and say it's in some way bogus or in some way performed. So it's an interest that you kind of register that someone is saying they're an individual, but then you also have to say, but you're not really. So it's actually quite a complex thing goes on when you dub someone a snowflake, I think.
And you point out in the book, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk more about the specific content of the plays that you discussed in this lecture as well, but there's something very theatrical about this, that they're almost casting these university students in a certain trope, in a certain role.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, I think that it's been interesting to see. I think there are a few fronts for that battle when you begin to spool through these sorts of comment threads. Certainly when talking about university students, it's interesting how people begin to define the idea of real life and oppose it to universities, that you begin to construct a little stage space full of all these students who are going around doing things that you think are very funny or very arbitrary or very stupid or very weird. So that's one strategy, I think, that began to really pop up, is that people were opposing this idea of real life to whatever they saw going on in universities.
Which is, I mean, I your book was helpful in me for me in kind of trying to inhabit this mental space that I find so bizarre, of people who think that trigger warnings are, you know, one of the greatest problems facing our society. Because, you know, in fact, in real life, there are trigger warnings. I mean, you go to the movie theater and you see, you know, this movie, I don't know what the rating system is in Britain, but, you know, in America, it's, you know, rated R for violence and suggestive content and language. And if you're upset by violence and suggestive content and language, then, you know, either you don't see that movie or you know that's what you're getting into going into the film. I mean, it's not like this is this alien idea that you're going to tell people a bit about what they're going to be exposed to before exposing them to it.
I think that's the thing. And one of the things, and I think I said this at some point in the book, that one of the things that became clear to me talking to students who had experienced sexual assault, so that was why the content warnings were there, speaking to some students and their accounts about why they found those warnings helpful, it wasn't often to give them the option of not going to the lecture. So the students I spoke to often said that actually the thing that was most helpful was that they could prepare themselves for the lecture. And in that respect, a trigger warning or content warning isn't really, as you say, any different from an R rating on a movie. It's just giving someone an idea of what kind of thing they're going to be accessing. And as I began to think, especially with the lecture, the idea of shock rather than say, I don't know, making an unexpected link, I couldn't really see any pedagogical purpose to that. I couldn't see anything that my students would get out of being, out of having their agency taken away from them in the course of a lecture like that.
So given that, you know, in any given lecture class, you're very likely going to have students who have experienced sexual assault. Some of this numbers you see are 1 in 4 women in university have been a victim of sexual assault. What beyond giving a trigger warning do you feel your responsibility as a lecturer is when you're discussing, you know, works that don't just mention sexual assault, but sort of, linger to a disturbing degree on sexual assault, as in Titus Andronicus?
I think that's a really interesting question. And I think with that notion of lingering is something I was trying to puzzle out in the course of writing these lectures, giving these lectures, and then thinking about them afterwards. Because on the one hand, you want to give a kind of proper attention to a subject, and that proper attention probably does need to linger in some ways on the particularly unpleasant aspects of how that subject's being presented. On the other hand, I suppose the problem that I found, say, discussing, a play like Titus Andronicus and the way in which it might treat sexual assault as this kind of abstract thing or as this kind of artistic trope to be worked around or worked with. The problem with that is that very soon, if you're discussing it, you are doing that as well. And certainly one of the things that I was conscious of in the course of giving these lectures is the fact that in a way I was conducting some kind of performance as well. And once I began to be aware of that, I began to think, here I am, a man who hasn't experienced trauma himself, standing behind a lectern, saying effectively, what an interesting experience this is to try and think about and try and analyze. So that balance is, I think, really, really difficult. And it's something that, certainly in the works that I was looking at, different playwrights were finding different ways of dealing with that. So something like in Blasted, in some ways that performance was trying to present itself as unintelligible, really confrontational, really disorientating. And that again was something I suppose that I could try and tease out, while also acknowledging that I was in some ways deconstructing something which wasn't mine to deconstruct, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I happened to read a long article about the making of Mad Max Fury Road yesterday. Mm-hmm. Do you know this film?
Yeah.
And part of the plot is that there are these women who have essentially been being held as sex slaves by this post-apocalyptic warlord. And I learned that the director actually had Eve Ensler, the author of the Vagina Monologues, like come on set and talk to the actresses about like real life sexual trauma. She'd been working with, I think, victims from the Congo. And this idea that sexual assault is both a real thing that happens in real life and a trope in popular culture is disturbing. Like there's something about that, you know, you want to be very careful about how it's being portrayed. And, you know, I think I'd love to hear your opinion about this, but definitely some people have believed that both Shakespeare and Sarah Kane don't treat the subject with the sort of sensitivity that it deserves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, that's really interesting about Mad Max. So the first time I saw Mad Max, I was in Austin, actually, and I was really struggling to cope with the heat. And I told myself that as a treat, I was going to go to the cinema and watch Mad Max, watch a big blockbuster. And it turned out to be a cinema where you could order burgers to your seat while you're watching the film. So this was absolutely fantastic for me. I had no idea that this was on the cards at all. And so I just sat there watching Mad Max, happily eating my burger and drinking my beer and thinking, you know, this is living. And it, the way I was consuming Mad Max was, you know, like the burger, there weren't any jagged edges for me to choke on, that more or less I was thinking, you know, this is a really kind of meaty, decadent film. And I can see in a way that artists, if they are going to put those jagged edges in for their consumers, for their spectators, they need to balance that out in some way with wanting to actually have those spectators stay and pay attention. So when Sarah Kane first pops up on the scene, a lot of critics are repulsed by what she's presenting. There's a critic writing Time Out magazine, I think, that says something along the lines of saying that Sarah Kane will soon learn that repeatedly firing a gun into the audience will only lead to diminishing returns. So I guess that's part of the challenge for these artists is how do you actually, how do you really trouble your viewer while keeping your viewer on the hook in some ways.
Right, because it's this delicate play of, you know, the audience's expectations and then subverting those expectations. But if they come to, you know, I was reading in the introduction to a collected work of a book of Sarah Kane's collected works, this idea that after the first couple of plays, people started to think, oh, it's another Sarah Kane play. It's going to be so, you know, graphically brutal and violent. And there does seem to be a kind of diminishing returns. And in her later work, she kind of, you know, finds arguably more disturbing, but less perhaps visceral ways to disquiet the audience.
Yeah, I think that's right. In a book called In Your Face Theatre, a critic called Alex Seitz reflects on lots of interviews he conducted with Kane. And Kane talks about the moment in the production of Blasted when I think the reviews got out there, people started knowing what kind of thing was going on. And she talked about people basically on stag do's, people beard up, turning up in the theatre and kind of having a great time in some ways. And in a way, I suppose the issue there was that people began to get a template for where their place was in this theatrical spectacle. And possibly in her later works, it's harder to settle into harder to settle into your seat in some ways, or to locate that seat, to know exactly where you are in relation to the action, or work out who is who. Whereas I wonder in Blasted, after that initial shock had passed and after the kind of paratexts of these performances began to ripple out there, people began to know in some ways what to expect, or in some ways began to decide for themselves how they wanted to react to it, maybe.
Do you know if there was any sort of, I don't know, trigger mid-90s version of what a trigger warning may have been on the play? Was there, you know, when you went to I think it was the Royal Court, wasn't it? You know, do you know if there was any kind of, well, if you're going to buy a ticket to this play, maybe you should know. Do you know if there was any of that?
I'm not sure. I know certainly productions now, I last went to see a production of Blasted, I think in 2014, and there were warnings all over that. So I'm not actually sure when Kane gets her warnings.
Yeah, I for certain people, just the name Sarah Kane is kind of a warning in itself.
Yes.
So part of what you talk about that's disturbing about Blasted is this idea of empathy. I mean, you know, going back to Aristotle, there's this idea you go to a play and you kind of identify with the central character. But Blasted really doesn't give you a lot of good options in terms of identification. You're either identifying with a victim of brutal violence, with somebody who is inflicting brutal violence, or with somebody who is first inflicting and then a victim of brutal violence. Is that part of what makes her plays so disturbing and perhaps so compelling?
I think so, and I think also it's the real challenge to empathy. So I think this is why talking about slapstick and tragedy in these lectures that first got their warnings and then first got the media coverage. It was slapstick that led me towards Kane, because I was thinking there are so many instances where you're looking at bodies behaving in these weird ways, these quite alien ways or inexplicable ways. And I think even on that basis, it becomes really challenging for a spectator. If someone suddenly falls to the floor, they have to very quickly try and supply some reason for that, which isn't given to them by the play. So there's that challenge to trying to form some kind of empathic response, even on a local basis. And then, as you say, the way the play goes in the case of Blasted is that if you form an empathic response in relation to one person, then something awful happens to the perpetrator of a rape upon that person who you were attached to empathically. So you end up having to try and work out who am I trying to understand? Who am I trying to sympathize with? So it's a play that really, really doesn't, it goes to really great lengths to prevent you easily feeling what someone else is feeling, I think is my take on it.
Yeah. I also happened to watch recently a documentary about Alexander McQueen, the fashion designer, who's a contemporary of Sarah Kane's. I mean, they're both kind of emerging in Britain in the mid 90s. And he talks of a lot in the documentary about wanting to expose what he felt was the ugliness of British society to his viewers, and, you know, writing about making clothes inspired by the brutal treatment of the rebels in the Jacobite Rebellion, and connecting that to Britain's history of colonialism at a time. I mean, I my knowledge of recent British cultural history is not super deep, but my sense is that the mid 90s were kind of a period of national celebration, you know, with Blur going on stage with the draped with the big British flag, and, you know, Blair and all of that. Do you feel like there's a social commentary in Kane as well, on that level of, no, actually what's going on in Britain is people are being, you know, raped all the time, and there's brutal violence meted out in the name of the nation. I mean, one of the third character in the trio in Blasted is a soldier. That seems pretty hard to ignore.
Yeah, I think that, I was quite young during the kind of Britpop era, but I was a fully paid up member of the Britpop fan club. I'm probably at that distance of age now where I'll look back at it and think, oh, that was a golden age, because I was young, and if not good looking, more good looking than I am now. So I look back at that era as you know, that was the peak, not just for the country, but for me. But actually thinking about something that Kane may have been picking up on. She says at one point in an interview with Alex Sietz that it struck her that there was more media outrage about her play, about the rape of a woman, than about the real life case of a woman being raped. And that seems something that she was really occupied with in relation to how the media was perhaps, I don't know, telling stories in a particular way. It's there perhaps also in the way people talk about Kane and the relation that they put her, the relation they posit between her and more canonical authors. So the quite famous Daily Mail review of Blasted, when it first premieres, is headlined "This Disgusting Feast of Filth," and it posits, you know, maybe Kane is imagining some kind of relation to Shakespeare, to especially something like King Lear, which also depicts atrocity. But it's straightforwardly, it's not a flattering comparison at all. It sees it as quite bogus. So it imagines that Kane will think that she is in some ways riffing off something like King Lear, but in a conservative, quite reactionary way. That Daily Mail review is clearly saying, no, Shakespeare is much, much better than this, that there are kind of values in Shakespeare and they aren't there in something like Sarah Kane. As very often, I think, in British culture, Shakespeare is kind of appropriated in that review as, I don't know, the golden standard of things being as they should be, or the golden standard of what we should all aspire to in some way. It's something I think Sarah Kane is quite careful to try and, again, to keep her audience disoriented. She says that this is a hotel room in Blasted, I think in Leeds, but beyond that doesn't really give us many clues about what's going on right outside the door until suddenly there's a big explosion and the world kind of comes barging in. I think she is implicitly questioning that kind of conservative tendency, that idea that there is some kind of stable monolith of culture. And actually in something like Blasted, she shows how volatile that can be, I think.
Yeah. I think this might be a good place to have you read a selection from the book, if that's all right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So this is from Shakespeare for Snowflakes. It's a section which looks back at some of the analysis of Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, and also mentions in passing Alice Sebold's memoir, Lucky. A slapstick body is dumped on the floor, subjected to violence, emptied out of volition, all by a contriving hand, and all for the entertainment of the spectator. In this light, presenting a rape victim as a slapstick body might not immerse the spectator in the spectacle so much as draw their attention to the patterns of coercion which govern it. Lavinia's eventual death underscores this. Titus, talking to the emperor, raises the case of Virginius, the centurion who killed his daughter with his own right hand because she was enforced, stained, and deflowered. He asks Saturninus whether it was well done, and once Saturninus replies in the affirmative, Titus stabs his own daughter accordingly, saying, "A pattern, precedent, and lively warrant for me, most wretched, to perform the like. Die, die, Lavinia, and thy shame with thee, and with thy shame thy father's sorrow, die." Here, as throughout the rest of the play, Lavinia has been obliged to kowtow to the ascetic demands of others. Her singular trauma is absorbed into an artistic precedent, and her volition, already injured by Demetrius and Chiron, is finally taken from her absolutely. She is killed, and her identity is rendered interchangeable with Virginius's long-dead, enforced, stained, and deflowered daughter. Lavinia's body is used as a prop, but also as a site for abstract analysis, comparison, and discussion. By looking at more or less slapstick presentations of sexual assault in drama, my lecture tried to explore the methods by which different playwrights present the bodies of assault victims as resistant, but ultimately subject to, the whims of other characters, and indeed to the playwright's own whims. In an ethically questionable way, my lectures were enacting a similar process, transforming the singular experience of being assaulted into a site of abstract discussion, indeed using the examples of assault victims as vehicles for a larger literary critical argument. In its way, this book reaffirms those problems. We have seen how Alice Sebold tried to take back possession of herself by writing a threat on her body. In some senses, an academic argument like this one takes the pen from her and writes "read me" on her body, insisting that she's not so much a person as a mesh of abstract and interesting concepts, a textual item to be analysed.
Yeah, that's great. So in a way, Shakespeare is doing to classical antiquity what this reviewer claimed Kane was doing to Shakespeare.
I think so. I think that's where I come down on Shakespeare. And it's one of those questions that I often throw at my students with, in particular, Titus Andronicus, which is to say, is this a critique of a literary tradition or is it just a contribution to it? And it's hard with Titus Andronicus. It's written quite near the start of his career. And I think there is there's a temptation to think this is Shakespeare showing he can stand alongside the big boys. But there's enough clumsiness, I think, in the way he presents this, I think, that he's really inviting us to wonder at what he's doing when he's presenting material like this.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, him trying to show that he's one of the big boys, because I think that was, you know, almost word for word a critique of Sarah Kane, right? That she's, okay, well, you've shown that you can, you know, you can tough it out with the rest of these, with, you know, Grieg or whoever else. And now go down and write a proper play, right?
And it's interesting, I think, looking at reviews at the time, just how gendered it is, actually, and how starkly gendered the idea of muscle standing alongside the big boys, that is that's how a lot of reviewers were conceiving it, I think.
Yeah. Do you think there might be some sense of, I mean, you know, I'm a playwright and I wrote plays, you know, when I was very young, that I understand intellectually what I was trying to do, but I do feel like I sort of inadvertently contributed to, you know, things I was trying to critique. Do you wonder that question about Shakespeare? Do you wonder if, you know, the Shakespeare of Hamlet and Lear would look back and say, "Oh, Titus Andronicus, not quite so proud of that one"? Or do you think he would have stood by it? I don't know. Maybe this is too much autobiographical speculation.
it's something that I've really wondered about in relation to trigger warnings and content warnings, actually. So as someone who isn't a playwright and as someone who was an actor to a really limited rubbish degree when I was a student, I've not really had to make these choices about how much I want to shock or challenge my audience. And actually it was while lecturing on this material once during a playwriting course. So there's a master's in playwriting here in Cambridge at the Institute of Continuing Education. And so I was talking to these playwrights about this material, and then at the end presented this PowerPoint slide of people commenting about the trigger warning, saying that this is ridiculous, students are snowflakes, and so on. And for the most part, this is quite a liberal seeming audience who are kind of on my side. And then one guy said that he was from somewhere in the north of England where they would be appalled by Kane. He was thinking of the people that he knew. And he said at one point, it's all right for you because you find this kind of thing interesting. But Kane is awful. I hate Sarah Kane. And the people that I know would hate Sarah Kane. And I went away and had to think about this quite a lot, because it was effectively saying, how was it that I was saying that a lecturer shouldn't shock a student for no obvious reason? And yet I was having it both ways and saying, well, if a playwright wants to do it, if Sarah Kane wants to do it, then that's fine, because all art is good art. And there was a definite inconsistency in my position on that. And in a way, I always evade that question, I think, and kind of say, I get the feeling that if a playwright is going to do something like that, or if any kind of artist is going to do that, then they need to make it worthwhile, I guess. But then what it is in the art itself that says to me personally, this is worthy of longer attention, is a really kind of wiggly, slippery question for me. With something like Titus Andronicus, it benefits obviously hugely from the fact that William Shakespeare's name is on it. And I think even within Shakespearean studies, it doesn't get talked about in the same terms as, say, King Lear or Hamlet or something like that. And that might be because at N people don't feel confident enough saying this is a deliberate, concerted attempt to unsettle an audience, rather than this is repeatedly firing a gun into the audience.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
But this is a question that is not unique to Titus Andronicus, the relationship of Shakespeare to these problematic tropes. I mean, you know, the debate about Othello. Is Othello a play critiquing racism, or is it simply a racist play? Or Merchant of Venice, is Merchant of Venice critiquing anti-Semitism, or is it just an anti-Semitic play? I mean, maybe a better way to think about this question is, in what ways is Shakespeare exploring similar questions in Titus Andronicus as he would later explore in plays like King Lear? I mean, it's not like he said, well, I'm going to write this one play about horrifically graphic violence, and then I'm going to write great sublime works of literature.
I think I was listening to a podcast with James Shapiro the other day, and James Shapiro points out that Shakespeare is very good at presenting different points of view on a particular question. When it comes to an early play like Titus Andronicus, and what I was saying earlier about the kind of clumsiness that Shakespeare works into the presentation of this violence, it does make me think that he's inviting our awareness of a hand making these things happen. Of actors being made to perform these simulations of atrocity. And I think by the time you get to later plays, Shakespeare's doing that with real verve. So in something like King Lear, the fact that in a way, in a massive digressive episode, we're watching the blind Gloucester being led to what he thinks is the edge of Dover Cliff, and then falling over, and then it transpiring only then that he's just on the flat ground and hasn't fallen as far as he thought and isn't dead as he thought he would be. That kind of clumsiness, I think, is something that Shakespeare is now really running with by the time he gets to something like King Lear, that he's really there saying, look at the manufacturing of this awfulness. Look at what I am making you all sign up for. And as I say in the book, that by the time you get to the end of King Lear, this is a spoiler alert, by the way, by the time you get to the end of King Lear and Cordelia is brought in dead and Lear is imploring everyone who's watching to notice that she's in some way alive, that there's a feather that is stirring with her breath, that there's a mirror that is misted with her breath. In one version of the text, his dying words are, look there, look there. Because we've seen the artifice, the clumsiness, the contrivance of Gloucester momentarily playing dead on the stage and then just getting back up again, we're really aware by the time we get to Cordelia's death that Shakespeare is really insisting that this happens, that all the other actors other than Lear are just agreeing that this actor is playing dead and she's not going to get back up again. So there's, I think where Titus Andronicus, that kind of clumsiness, that kind of contrivance is happening all over the place. By the time you get to a play like King Lear, that kind of power play over his actors, but also over his audience, is really being directed to one very powerful emotional gut punch at the end of the play.
Yeah, and Shakespeare throughout his plays is really obsessed with this idea of theatricality and pointing out this is fake, but it's also real in this other way. I mean, it's very, you know, if it weren't written in the 17th century, you'd call it postmodern.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorite bits in Antony and Cleopatra is kind of at the coming up to her lowest ebb. Cleopatra imagines some saucy lictors will bring my Antony drunk and reeling forth, and she imagines that some squeaking pipstraw of an actor will one day buoy her greatness. And it's kind of it's just brilliant because in the story Cleopatra is kind of losing now, she's on her way down, and of course we are at that moment, if we're in Shakespeare's theatre, we're seeing a boy, just as she said would be the case, playing out her greatness. But then there's something in it in a kind of very postmodern kind of way, which is a massive power play. She somehow managed to anticipate forward hundreds of years into Shakespeare's theatre correctly. You know, she's called it. So there's a kind of wonderful meta-theatricality, which isn't just its endpoint. It doesn't just undermine the story. It begins to show, again, a certain kind of power over one's own presentation at that point.
Did you happen to see the production of King Lear where Anthony Scher played Lear?
I did. I saw it at the cinema. So they sometimes do live.
Yeah.
So I saw it there.
And that I loved that production so much. And I feel like one of the things that it was so clever about is just showing how much Lear's inability to continue performing the role of Lear is because he like loses all of his extras and his costumes and his set pieces. Yeah. You know, that it's about sort of the stage managing of power in a way.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I mean throughout his career it's something that Shakespeare is just really interested in. I think of something like the Henry IV plays, where again it's a massive theatrical digression. But when Falstaff and Prince Hal take turns playing the king, so they'll use a cushion for a crown, and they'll just take turns playing the king and interrogating the other one. It's at once a kind of celebration of just theatricality, of the fact that to be a king, all you need really is the right props. But then I feel that Shakespeare being Shakespeare does connect up to something that is sort of more kind of essential and kind of thrilling about theatricality. So he isn't just emptying theatricality out of meaning, I don't think. And I think most productions that I've normally seen of this moment is that when Hal pretends to be the king, there is a kind of thrill, because when a prince dresses up as a king, suddenly the magic is more imminent, you know, that and so it's Shakespeare's meta theatricality again, it often isn't its own little trick. It doesn't exist for the sake of itself. It normally is trying to say something about the power inherent to the performance in some ways.
Right. I feel like often when this is discussed, it's like this sort of debunking idea of Shakespeare's meta theatricality. Like, he's Shakespeare. He believes in theater, right? Like, he likes theater. If he didn't like theater, he wouldn't be Shakespeare.
I mean, it's one of the things. Now I've got the Henry plays in my mind. I mean, one of the most wonderful exhibitions of that, I think, is Falstaff, who is simultaneously this this person who is capable of great imaginative, witty leaps, but who is also very much just occupying the stage. And it's something that I always find fascinating is just how important Falstaff's fatness is to Shakespeare throughout those plays. So you've got this incredibly funny character, but in many ways he is just kind of huffing and puffing and moving about the stage and you know, just occupying the stage in front of us. So again, I think it's that fusion of imaginative capability, but also very much the presence, the very real presence of someone just stood in front of us on the stage.
Yeah. So in my introduction, I mentioned that we'd be talking about YouTube videos of people falling over in public. So I don't want to deprive our audience of that discussion and give them the false impression that your book is all literary analysis of the great masters. So you talk about a couple of these, you know, these real life examples of this slipperiness between, you know, no pun intended, between tragedy and slapstick. The discussion of, is it Michael Gove,
mm-hmm.
who slips on paving stones, and he was the conservative education minister or something like that?
Yeah. So Michael Gove,
this is like a person that a British person would know, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not sure how many people would be pleased about knowing about him, but he's a public figure. He has been prominent in government for some time now, and as Minister for Education, he was, I think it's fair to say, very unpopular with many educational professionals, and he referred often to people who opposed or resisted his various educational reforms as the blob. So he saw that kind of, he saw the kind of resistance from people within the profession in those sorts of terms. And so when Michael Gove is, it's in a YouTube video. I encourage everyone to watch it, in fact. And it's footage of Michael Gove walking down Downing Street. I think he's on his way to a cabinet meeting in 2010. And he slips over and he immediately gets up, I think hoping that no one's seen, but there are some journalists and photographers there. And in the footage, you hear someone go, "Way!" as he falls over. And then someone says, "Are you okay, sir?" And he does the thing that you do when you fall over, where he simultaneously tries to pretend he's okay, but he also sort of stiffens his gait a little bit to show that he has been hurt a bit. So he kind of tries to take command a little bit of the situation, I think, by saying, I and he smiles. So it's a way, I suppose, if it was me, it's a way of saying, I'm okay, but I was hurt a bit. So don't laugh too much, but I am okay. And I'm kind of back in control. So when I first saw this video in 2010, I think I was pretty much as far as posting the link into a Facebook status, because I obviously found it funny, and then began to think, well, this is problematic, because I do actually feel sorry for this man. And, you know, political discussion can't allow that degree of empathy. And I thought it would complicate whatever political point I was probably trying to make at the time. And then when I came back to it while writing this book, I thought actually it was really interesting to think about that, to think about what was going on by the fact that this YouTube video exists even. And when you look for it on YouTube, you'll find things like Michael Gove falls over and over and over, open brackets, close brackets, open brackets and over, close brackets. And things like Michael Gove falls over 10-hour Eminem remix. So it's it's a popular video.
Well, what's so fascinating to me about this video is it's like not a particularly brutal fall. And yet some of the comments are like, I wish he died.
Yeah.
So, and this is like, you know, getting to the larger point of the book, this line between, you know, what is the kind of falling over, the kind of being hurt that is funny and the kind that is tragic, you know, it'd be very nice and easy to say, well, if they're really hurt, then you can't laugh. But part of the reason people seem to be laughing at this is that they think he did get hurt and they're glad that he got hurt and they wish he'd gotten more hurt. I mean, what's going on there?
It's a mess, as far as I could say. It's not very insightful to say. As soon as you begin to analyze things on the internet, wow, it's a mess. But the comments underneath that video fall into a few different categories. There aren't many, it has to be said, that say, poor guy. There are people, I think, who read his fall according to how they would conduct that fall. So they talk about it in terms of him trying to reclaim his dignity, and they find that funny. That, you know, that people find it funny because it's quite an intelligible act. And then there are other people, I think, who glory in watching this and kind of give themselves permission to enjoy his misfortune because they sort of transform him into a not real person. So they say things like, Michael Gove is a, hang on, I had to look this up, is a spermatozoon, is a singular, I believe, spermatozoon in a suit at one point, or he's so slimy it wouldn't have hurt him, or things like that. And then there are the people who, I guess they would say that they're driving for another source of comedy with its own extremity, if they were to defend themselves. So there are some things in there which... are pretty abysmal things to say about someone. But they're so far-fetched that it's almost like, presumably they're thinking, we now come out the other side of violent into cartoon violence again. There's one comment there which says something like, I wish he had fallen on an HIV-ridden needle, I think, which is a really ugly thing to say, and if they mean that is grotesque. But
there is a sense that if you get cartoonish enough, it almost pushes it off the other end, and it's back to being not real, right? It's like it's the Godard thing of my movies don't have blood, they have red, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That if you go so over the top, it's okay.
Yeah, and I think that's there in some of the comments. I think that the needle one was the example that I give in the book of that kind of phenomenon, that you almost end up with something kind of Tom and Jerry-ish, that he would fly up in the air and somehow land on the point of a needle. Whereas there are some others in there which it seems to me are right in that zone of saying, I want to insist that he has a real body, but I also want violence to happen to that body. So there are some comments, which are quite a few actually, which will say, I wish he had broken his neck, which is it seems is the kind of trauma that insists upon a kind of human body sustaining damage.
Right. It's like, it would be very morally comforting to say, well, these are dehumanizing him, but some of them are actually quite insistent on his humanity while wishing him harm. Do you think part of what's going on here is this kind of punching up idea? The idea that, you know, this, it's not just some guy, it's a very powerful guy who also, you know, seems to be, perhaps callously indifferent to the suffering of others that's been meted out by the conservative government. And so it's okay to laugh at him because, you know, here I am just some nobody and here he is this very powerful person.
I think some people are making that play.
Do you think that works?
I suppose what some of these attempts are doing in the comments. So there's one, I think, that says, I hope he broke his neck, got paralyzed, And was disabled and then had to go and claim disability benefit from his own government. The point being that his government had made loads of cuts to benefits and it would be very hard for him to get benefits from his own government, which I presume is an effort to kind of weigh his humanity alongside the humanity of disabled people who had struggled to get benefits as a result of his government. And so in a way, I suppose, was trying to say those people aren't abstract any more than this guy is. So it was, speaking as someone who teaches English literature, I didn't think the writing out of that model was very sophisticated or very successful. But that seemed to be the argumentative strategy of that kind of comment. And the other thing that should be said, I think, is that some of these comments, I'm aware, I think, that when I was looking at these comments, that these I'm really stretching the idea that you can apply something like literary analysis to them. The writers probably haven't thought through what they're doing as being something conceptually interesting, that there are some straightforward expressions of ill will, I think. And I think maybe in some ways the idea of punching up might give some of those people the feeling of a free pass, that this isn't a man, this is a kind of figure of government. I think that's one of the things that's becomes increasingly uncomfortable as you go through those kinds of comments. That said, I mean, I talk about this in Shakespeare for Snowflakes as well. When you begin to look through comments on something like Breitbart, it seems that there are very similar strategies which are very much performing themselves as punching down, unapologetically punching down. So in the book, I talk about an opinion column written by a writer called James Dellingpole, where he complains that someone left during one of his talks, which he'd been invited to give by the Conservative Association at Cambridge University, and people walked out, and he complains about a woman who left, in his words, visibly distraught. And then when you go through the comments underneath, the comments there, I guess almost as a game, it seems, begin to circle around that woman and eventually wish rape upon that woman. So again, I don't know whether that's experience for those people writing comments as part of a game, as part of a performance. If you punch down hard enough, that in some ways is part of the fun or part of the performance. Yeah.
I'd love to talk about this idea of the very short distance between the most sort of troglodyte racism and sexism of the online right versus the most cleaned up sanitized version of these same arguments. You talk about a book called The Coddling of the American Mind, and you describe it as being a kind of theater. Could you talk about what's interesting to you about this book?
Yeah, so it's a book called The Coddling of the American Mind, written by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. And my impression is that they are kind of flag bearers for an interesting kind of argumentative tendency. My impression is particularly in the US. So I think Greg Lukianoff is head of an institution called the Federation of Individual Rights in Education, I think, FIRE. And we have these people in the UK as well, who kind of anoint themselves as defenders of free speech. And Lukianoff and Haidt write out this argument, which basically they, as far as I can see, they're basically talking about snowflakery, but they confer upon it a sort of more academic sounding term. They use vindictive protectiveness. And so for them, things like trigger warnings and things like no platforming, things like students or faculty members picking up on microaggressions within university context are all the same problem. They're all basically the same. and it's something that they kind of rail against. And I think they more or less set out that what they're defending is a particular branch of liberal humanism, that everyone should be confronted with things that are difficult or challenging in order to, if they have to, debunk them, but otherwise kind of learn from them and you know, take them apart. So that's kind of the premise of their book, I think. What's really interesting in the way that the book is written is that in order to do this, they will occasionally swerve into the same literary strategies that we've been talking about in YouTube comments, that you find ways to, it's not even really to deprive someone of sympathy. It's to deprive them of their capacity to have sympathy. So you begin to talk about people who might be attentive to the needs of others, say, as doing that unthinkingly, doing it sort of automatically, doing it in a kind of either crazy or automatic or bogus performed kind of way. They turn the performance of empathy a few times, I think, into something that is presented as something, if not outright comic in the book, they do present it as something that's unthinking, perhaps a bit stupid.
Right. And then this idea of performativity, I mean, this is connecting back to the idea of performativity in Shakespeare. They do really seem to mean performativity as being something not genuine, right? Like, that seems to be how they understand that term.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a word that they smuggle in to some of their discussions of, for example, PTSD. So they'll talk about if someone has suffered from genuine trauma, then they should seek therapy or something like that. So it is something that even while they talk through something like PTSD, one of the curious things I find about the book is that they are completely open to the idea that people might have mental health crises. And one of the things that I find most troubling about the book, in a way, is that they allow for the fact that people might be traumatized, but then the way that they think people should get over it is, it seems to me, quite a garbled version of exposure therapy. So at one point they liken getting over PTSD to taking microdoses of peanuts if you have a peanut allergy, which, I mean, peanut allergies and PTSD, this isn't my area, but they're different, right?
Yeah, I don't think they're the exact same. I think that's fair.
And then they do things like saying that cognitive behavioral therapy is a particularly valuable, important thing to be aware of. But then they do things like they provide principles of CBT in a couple of pages at the end of their book. And then they also more or less say that the principles of CBT and the principles of confronting someone with something that might potentially re-traumatize them are kind of the same. So one of the interesting things about the book is it does have this shape of thought through, academic, very footnoted kind of arguments, but then we'll make these conceptual leaps, which are quite dangerous. That, in my view, that to analogize PTSD and peanut allergy is not helpful. And so when they liken CBT to, say, me lecturing on the slapstick qualities of rape to potentially a rape victim, those aren't the same thing. And one of the curious things I think about the book as it's written is that one of the chapters begins with a first person account of someone who is going through chronic depression, experiences suicidal ideation, and then as a sort of writerly technique, then says that they then reveal that was the first-hand account of one of the writers, that they themselves had experienced that. So I suppose, again, speaking about it as a piece of literature, what I find really curious about that is when it comes to talking about the possibility of real trauma, the possibility of real mental suffering and a mental health crisis, they do switch to inhabiting a first person's perspective. But then when they move to the bigger architecture of how they think universities should be, that's when suddenly we don't really pay attention to the personal individual experiences of all the students of say 100 in a lecture theatre. Some of them may have been raped. Some of them may be going through a mental health crisis right then. Some of them, their parents might have committed suicide. Some of them might have been in a car crash last year. Like the idea that we can consider them utterly interchangeable is something really troubling. And to write individuals as interchangeable doesn't actually get you off the hook, I think. You still have to think about how you might empathize with people, how you might try your best not to deny individuals agency within the teaching room, I think.
This interchangeability question is so fascinating to me. I mean, I talked about this a little bit about at the beginning of the interview, but I mean, you know, aren't these the people who are always talking about how, you know, sacred and distinct every person is, and, you know, talking about how, you know, leftists just want to standardize everything? I mean, it's this idea. I wrote down a quote. It says, this is the authors of The Coddling of the American Mind. The DSM-3 emphasized that the traumatic event was based not on a subjective standard. It had to be something that would cause most people to have a severe reaction. So they're arguing that there should be some sort of an objective standard for psychological harm. I'm not even sure how that would be possible.
I think
it's psychology. Like it's about the individual psychic responses that people have to traumatic events. Like we wouldn't expect that. It's not a broken leg. We wouldn't expect it to be the same for everybody.
I think that's something that when I quote the DSM in Shakespeare for Snowflakes, I point out that in one of the definitions, it does have a kind of inconsistency, or it has a problem if you're attempting to diagnose it from the outside, as far as I can see, again, just looking at it as say an item of literature, which is to say that it's something that is causing someone this psychological pain. And it's something that happens after some kind of trauma, which is kind of out of the ordinary, which most people wouldn't experience. So Lukianoff and Haidt, they say the DSM-3 emphasized that the traumatic event was not based on a subjective standard. It had to be something that would cause most people to have a severe reaction. So you have this weird transition between most people. So, you know, that how on earth do we define that? And then the idea that this is something that exists within the individual. How are we able to imagine ourselves into a place where we understand what a trauma is like if most people haven't experienced that trauma?
Right. It's asking, this is how most people would react to something most people don't experience, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So again, it's completely contingent upon a sort of imaginative, empathic exercise. We have to be able to do that. Otherwise, we're not going to understand.
Yeah. And then it seems like there's a further problem of even if you could come to that sort of a standard, I mean, why wouldn't we think that some people might be traumatized by things that wouldn't traumatize other people? I mean, even most combat veterans don't experience PTSD, but some of them do. You know, I mean, by their standard, you would want to think that, oh, okay, so if only 20% of people who come back from, you know, fighting in Iraq have PTSD, then PTSD is not real or something?
I think that was the most... It was the thing I came closest to when I was spooling obsessively through the comments under the media reports about the warnings on this lecture. It was the thing I came closest to creating my own profile for and replying to the comments. But then I thought that way madness lies.
Right. You could just publish a whole book about it. So
yeah. I'll let this get good and cold, and then I'll serve it back up. But I think the thing that was occurring to me, and I think a lot of people who were really trying to speak up for the idea of warnings on these lectures, was to say it really doesn't put anybody out. And even if there's just, say, one person who would benefit from that warning being on the lecture, then why not have it? And I did find that really hard to understand, that logic, for lots of people saying that these warnings are are in some ways inhibiting someone's learning experience. It really doesn't seem to cause anyone it doesn't prevent anyone attending. It doesn't prevent anyone engaging with it in a particular way. And actually the opposite is probably true, in that it probably enables some people to participate in the lecture better than they would have done otherwise, I think.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Well, thank you so much for being on the program. I found your book so interesting, and I feel like it's, you know, probably the best presentation of this sort of an argument I've seen about content warnings in university classrooms, because, you know, you write as somebody who actually does lecture about quite traumatic things, and you want to be sensitive about that, but you also, you know, do want to insist that this is a proper study for literary analysis, and you very expressly don't want to close off this discussion, but you want to open it up in a more productive way. So I found that very valuable.
That's great. Thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
Do you have anything else that you're working on that you'd like to tell us about?
I mean, yeah, there are a few projects here and there. If you want to see them in their infancy, then I do have a website, shakespeareforsnowflakes.com. So there are a few different things where I'm kind of thinking about how people translate different kinds of performance into print in some ways, how print might sort of be one of the media by which we think about things like embodiment and compulsion as well. But yeah, that's in its early stages at the minute.
All right. Thanks. Well, I'll be sure to check that out.